If you've ever wondered how to get cybersecurity professionals fired up, all you have to do is get them talking about companies who are getting it wrong. Christy Terrell is a partner at a security consulting firm called Bishop Fox. The Uber incident hit just before our recording of this podcast. It was telling not just because the information of 57 million people was breached, but that Uber managed to find a new way to behave badly once it was discovered.
What's incredulous about Uber is that given some of the recent breaches with Yahoo, Equifax, these companies that have disclosed information for millions of their own consumers, that to have Uber also know that there was a vulnerability of a similar magnitude for their customers' information and not take it seriously enough internally to inform their CEO and to do something about it more proactively, that's what's the most shocking and disappointing.
Today, we're going to be talking to Christy about a number of aspects of cybersecurity. But before we get into the heart of the podcast, I just thought I'd share her thoughts on yet another recent issue. This is about a company that completely blew it when it came to managing a bug discovered via a bug bounty program. Gosh, this is fun.
So DJI is the perfect case study for why bug bounty programs need to be planned out more carefully. By not defining their scope clearly, by not communicating effectively with their researchers, they not only pissed off the research community, but eventually their vulnerability got exposed publicly, wasn't protected by the bug bounty program. And now you have the researcher revealing all of the faults of their communication. And now no one will probably ever want to submit a bug to DJI. And if you want the research community to be on your side and to help you out and to responsibly disclose these vulnerabilities through these programs, you have to treat them with respect and care that it deserves.
Okay, let's take a breath, calm ourselves down, and get into many aspects of cybersecurity, including bug bounty programs, penetration testing, preventing social engineering hacks, and more. I'm John Pryle. Welcome to the Impact Podcast. So, Christy, why don't we start off with you introducing yourselves to our listeners?
Hi, my name is Christy Terrell. I'm a partner at Bishop Fox. We are a company that focuses on security assessments. I've been in the security industry for over 15 years, and I currently share my knowledge with clients through speaking at conferences, writing articles for Forbes, and doing podcasts like this.
So to start, when it comes to programming, the old adage that prevention is better than the cure holds true. I mean, it's been a while since I've seen the numbers, but everyone knows that catching bugs during design time is cheaper than catching bugs during coding or testing, and please don't let things happen in production. I don't think that's under dispute. But let's talk about security. We're going to be talking about some external testing techniques that happen late in the cycle, but doesn't the adage hold true here too?
Right. It's easy to think of those external validation as this is where we should start. Let's have an expert tell us if we're doing well. But that should not be your first step, because all that external researchers and penetration companies can do is validate whether you've built something securely. And if you haven't been trying to build it securely, if you haven't been putting in those best practices or checking or scanning your own code for security vulnerabilities, I can tell you right now what the results are going to be of your external test. There's going to be problems. So it really should just be a final validation of good practices that you're already doing, but their starting point needs to happen with your development team much earlier on in the process.
Can you give me your sense of how companies should get started when they think about security? What should they be doing first?
Right. There's two ways to think about security that both are, I think, valid. The first is to think about what's the worst case scenario. You might be only a 5-person company, a 10-person company. You may only have a couple of clients, but what's the worst case scenario and work backwards from that? Is it data leakage from your customers? Is it operationally your system not being available? So that's one way to start, is to say, well, what can we not sustain? And then work backwards. Are we prepared for that worst case? The other way is to do a threat model mindset, a threat model approach, which is not so much what the worst case scenario is, but what are all the possible things that could go wrong, and then prioritize those in terms of impact and likelihood. Like, you know, if you're using Amazon cloud computing, if they've had issues recently and you're reliant on them, think about, do we have another backup? Do we have another option? So that's another way to think about it from a threat modeling standpoint. Our product and our business, you know, what could go wrong? And are we prepared?
I do like your big picture response, and it nicely augments this thought of getting security built in early. So when you think about it, as you say, where things can go wrong, how do you see programs like bug bounties and penetration testing fitting into an organization's overall security approach?
Both of those options should be something that you do when you've already tried everything internally first. So I always recommend that you're scanning your own code with off-the-shelf products to look for vulnerabilities, automatic scanning. That's something that's very easy for your own development teams to do. And that should be a first step before you spend the increased amount of effort or money to have someone else do that for you when it's really your best practice. It's almost, we use the term security hygiene pretty frequently because these security practices are things that you have to do on a day-to-day basis. You can't just, it's like going to the dentist. You can't not brush or floss your teeth for 6 months and then go to the dentist and have them do it for you and expect to have a clean bill of health. Right? They will clean your teeth, they will floss your teeth, but you should have been doing that for the previous 6 months. And that's kind of how you have to think about all these practices is you can never truly outsource the responsibility for security to other firms or to other, you know, I guess, vendors.
So let's take a closer look at bug bounties. Can you give me just a sense of the history of bug bounties? How far back does it go?
Bug bounties as a common option only appeared in the last several years. But there have been attempts to start this type of research approach to having researchers around the world help you identify bugs. That's been around for about 15, 20 years. Again, not a common option until recently. And it's only been the last 5 years or so that you have various vendors and platforms and services that can help facilitate a bug bounty program.
What made that palatable? In other words, you're giving control or access to, you're kind of asking people to come after you. So what made it popular? Why has it succeeded so far?
I think one practical reality is because of the talent scarcity in cybersecurity. So, you know, any way that companies can look for access to talent is really important. And Bug Bounty offers you the ability to have researchers look for vulnerabilities in your code, and they could be based anywhere around the world. They don't have to be employees of yours. They essentially are independent contractors for all, you know, purposes. And so if you're struggling to find your own internal team that can help you do this, if, you know, penetration testing seems to be more expensive, bug bounty has been an easy thing to latch onto as a way to widen the net of expertise. I think that's one reason it's gained popularity. The other reason it's gained popularity is because recent development with agile and more iterative releases of code, you have companies are not just releasing new code every 6 months or once a year. They're actually releasing new features and new code, sometimes once a day. And bug bounty gives you this continuous ability to have people looking at your code set. So it's kind of like constant / continuous testing. And that seems more attractive than doing a time-boxed point-in-time penetration test that might be out of date within a month.
I'm actually quite glad you mentioned Agile as a new driver of this need. You know, I'm thinking that my prevention better than the cure storyline did feel to me a bit waterfallish and maybe old schoolish, although I don't think it is. But what are some of the pros and cons and some of the gotchas with bug bounties?
The biggest gotcha is that I think it costs companies more money than they think. So it sounds great. You think, great, I have access to all this talent that I don't have to actually put on my payroll, and I only have to pay them if they find a vulnerability. That sounds really enticing. And the common range and price for vulnerabilities is anywhere between $250 to about $1,750. You know, $1,750 is a common range. That's for critical vulnerabilities, and $250 for more low-end vulnerabilities. So if you think, well, we might have 20 bugs, but multiply that times $1,000 each, that's $20,000. We can afford that. However, that's not the total cost of operations for a bug bounty program. There's actually a significant amount of work that goes in to your team or someone needing to triage all of the influx. Because to get 20 validated bugs, you might get 2,000 submissions. So someone with knowledge, with technical expertise, has to parse through all the submissions, make sure which ones are valid, which ones aren't valid, because if you do not respond in a timely manner to the researchers, and if you don't honor your commitment to pay them for the vulnerabilities that they found, you then damage your relationship with this, the security community. And that's not a position that you want to be in either. So I think there's a lot more risk and level of effort and some hidden costs in bug bounty programs that most companies don't realize.
I knew we'd get back to that DJI story. But seriously, what my takeaway here is that a company has to go into this with eyes wide open, looking for both the good and the bad.
Absolutely. And even if you're not an expert in this, and this is the first time you're considering bug bounty, it's the first time that you're even looking into it, just think logically end to end what might happen. If you get lots of submissions, who internally in your company are you going to free up from their other responsibilities to sit here and look through the queue? How are you going to engage with these researchers? How are you going to go back and ask them questions if you don't understand what they submitted? Just all of those mechanics of the process. How quickly are you prepared to fix these vulnerabilities? Because if you put out a bug bounty program, and let's say you have a very easy vulnerability to find, let's say you have SQL injection or cross-site scripting, that'll be a submission will come in within hours of someone telling you they found it. If you don't go fix that, you're going to get researcher after researcher after researcher submitting those same vulnerabilities to you almost nonstop until that vulnerability isn't there anymore. So is your development team going to be prepared to go and immediately fix these? Because if not, that's how your like tick list of submissions is going to increase exponentially.
Let's switch over to penetration testing. And you made a little comparison that bug bounty might have been a little simpler way to get started, although now it's getting pretty scary to me. What's the history? Does penetration testing go back further than bug bounties?
Yes, penetration testing is the more, I guess, traditional approach, and actually has been going on in some capacity since really the 70s in the military, but more as in a private sector as an option has really been happening since the early 90s. And penetration testing is a bit of a safer way to find out your vulnerabilities because you have a firm that you've contracted who's under explicit NDA. You have a very small team from that firm who has access to your systems, and anything they find is only between you and them. They have no right to publish that. They have no recourse. They can't make any additional money on the vulnerabilities that they find in your system. So you get that lead time. You get to choose how quickly you fix it. You get to choose if and how you even disclose those vulnerabilities to other parties or your customers. You have a lot more protection. And if this is the first time you're trying to get external validation on is your product secure, it's a much safer way to dip your toe in the water. Because if you don't know what to expect, if you don't know what findings are going to come out of this, you don't want to be surprised by, again, the deluge on a bug bounty program. And I just think a safer way to start that process.
Wow. It's not that I ever thought that these two different approaches were the same, but there are some fundamentally different outcome options here now. So please talk to me about the goods and the bads here.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, there is an expiration date on those results. If you push code out once a week and you have people assessing a code base from last month, they might have said, okay, here's 12 vulnerabilities, but they can't guarantee that those are the only 12 because new code has been pushed out, new features have been added. So there is some sense of it is a point in time. So that is a downside if you have a rapid release cycle, and that's something to realize. They're also, because of the talent scarcity we do have, not all people who offer penetration testing are created equal. Not all firms are created equal. And this is a very specialized subject, and it can be difficult to parse through who's good, who's bad, what level of value you're going to get. And there's no shortcut I can really offer to that other than to just go off of referrals and ask for other customers to vouch for the quality of the work of the firm that you choose.
So that's, I guess, one of the best practices that I'm taking out of this is pick the right company for sure.
I think it's important. You are looking for someone to come in and find all of your dirty laundry that you've like hid under the rug, right? Like you want someone who's going to, you're going to trust, and that you're also, if you're going to give that level of access and kind of be vulnerable yourself as an organization to say, tell us where our weaknesses are, you want them to do as thorough a job as possible. You're not going to go through that pain and suffering of having to go through this process without having the best results come out of it.
Right. And from reading I've done and watching Mr. Robot, talk to me a bit about social engineering as another attack surface that's got nothing to do with technology per se.
Well, social engineering is always going to be a problem. It always has been a problem. And people have social engineered their way through all types of situations throughout history. I mean, social engineering is just like a new term that we have in kind of the cyberspace, but it's essentially fraud, right? Someone tricking you into giving them access to your information or, you know, by you clicking on a link. So you're not going to ever prevent it entirely. And what the hope is within cybersecurity, what we're hoping and planning is that we can have better and better technical controls in place. So there's less of a human element because we're not going to perfect humans. Humans are imperfect. So we're never going to solve it by just training people. We're not going to be able to just tell people, don't click on links you don't know and solve the social engineering problem. But we can try to mitigate it through better technical controls. So that's just a different, a threat vector, a different kind of attack possibility that we have to be conscious of, but none of us are ever going to solve in the short term.
So somewhere along the way, you're going to get hacked, whether it's through technology or somebody convincing you to click on a link or giving you their pet's name and you figure out that that's the key part of their password or whatever.
Sure. Well, all of security for a number of years has tried to talk about like layered security, a layered approach to security. So you don't just have, you know, one door between you and the sensitive information. You should have like multiple locks and keys and doors and things you'd have to open to get to the crown jewels. And social engineering just should be one of your defense mechanisms. So let's say you do click on a link, and by clicking on that link, someone now has access to your email, to your desktop. There should hopefully be other controls in place that prevent them from pivoting to other systems on your network. So some of the best practices for security that we always talk about having segmented networks, about not reusing passwords, if you did all those things correctly, you would limit the impact of a social engineering attack.
Should organizations be looking at both bug bounties and external penetration testing companies? Where do they overlap? And as we begin to wrap this up, do me a favor, please share with me the kind of the big picture of how a company should be approaching security.
There's a lot of good practices that every company should be investing their time in. Everything from designing their products securely from an architectural standpoint to investing time in the developers securely coding those features and then doing that self-assessment, doing code scans, running vulnerability scans of your own code set. Those are all the right things to do. At the point that from a business standpoint, you either get requests from your customers, you're getting pressure, external pressure, to have some external validation, that's typically when companies get their first penetration tests, for startups in particular. Because as a startup, your money is tight and you want to invest in things wisely. But if you have customers telling you, we want to make sure you've had someone assess your product and do a security assessment, that's usually when firms get the call to say, hey, we need to get a penetration test done. So there's practices you should be doing in the first place. Penetration testing should usually be the next thing that you do when you need external validation. And then bug bounty can be a great way once you've matured and you've done several pen tests and you feel like you have a secure product. Bug bounty at that point can be a good way to see if there's any other vulnerabilities out there. As you do new code releases, maybe there's something that no one else caught, and then it can be a cost-effective way to find that variance between what you caught, what the penetration testers caught, and then maybe bug bounty can offer you that final, you know, no one else can seem to find anything else, so we actually think we are in a good standing.
Got it. It's a very logical approach. And I really like this business person's view, particularly as it comes to costs of bug bounties as that final, final step. Now, I'd like to change gears and really carefully tread on one last topic. I have not, nor will I ever ask a female guest how it feels to be a female in a specific tech field. But I would like to share a statistic and ask a question about it. I found a data point that states that 11% of the cybersecurity workforce are women. So what advice would you have for attracting and retaining women in this important and growing field?
So yeah, we are women in the cybersecurity industry. We are in a minority. And I think one of the best ways to attract and retain the women who do want to be in the industry and who do have the necessary skills is, first of all, to have some sort of visible female leadership presence in the company. I hear from lots of women that they're skeptical about joining an organization that has no other women in technical positions or in leadership positions. I hear that that's very important to women who are trying to join technical teams, whether it's engineering teams or security teams. So I think that's one thing about attracting talent, is to be cognizant of what the makeup of your current company looks like, and is that going to be attractive to women? And then in terms of retaining them, you know, every person, every woman has their own, you know, lifestyle and what kind of work balance life that, you know, they want. So I don't have any prescription for that, but I just think recognizing that adding more women to your workforce makes it more diverse, and there are going to be different needs, and trying to figure out, you know, how are you going to retain people on an individual basis? Like, what is it that they need? What is it for their career growth? What is it for their personal balance that they might need to stay with you and not go to another company?
Christy, thank you so much for sharing that. You know, I think these comments should be heard by every tech exec and really taken to heart. But to close on this main subject of this podcast, there's a lot to think about. There are lots of choices to make, and every decision is an opportunity to get it right or wrong. So my thanks to Christy Terrell for helping us understand these nuances. For the Impact Podcast, I'm John Pryle. Thanks for listening. If you like what we're doing, we'd appreciate your telling other people about the show. Better yet, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or write a review. Doing so will really help ensure that more people can find us. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the Impact Podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you go to find your podcasts.